Parshas Vayikra, all about Karbanos. Lots of halachas in the parasha, although most of them are pretty technical and pretty specific to the sacrificial rites, to the temple rites. There are, however, a number of halachas of broader application or beyond the temple service that are derived from verses in the parasha. Particularly, the last half of the parasha deals with karban chatas, the various sorts of karban chatas, the sin offerings. They're brought for a variety of sins, and I guess it's interesting or ironic that it's actually in the course of describing the laws of these sin offerings that we actually learn about the halachas that make up these underlying sins. We learn some information about what the Torah calls a sin. In particular, toward the end of the parasha, we have the karban ol v'yared. That's the chatas that is brought on a sliding scale. If you can afford it, you bring an animal for the chatas. If you can't, you bring a bird, fowl. If you can't even do that, you bring a meal offering, grain, and kind of cake. So that is brought for a few specific averis. One of them we discussed last year is what we call shvuas eidus, the failure to testify. A person has an obligation to testify in criminal proceedings and civil proceedings. If Beis Din summons him, if the plaintiff or the defendant summons him to testify, he has an obligation to testify. If he does not, and if he refuses to, and if he denies, if he perjures himself and denies that he has useful information, he takes a shvua to that effect. Nefesh kisechata v'shama kol Allah, he hears a shvua and he, under penalty of perjury, basically declares that he has no information. V'hu eid oro yada, really, he is a witness, he has seen something, he does know something that would be relevant to the case at hand. Im lo yagid v'nasav ano, if he does not testify, he's considered sinful and he brings this karban. Last year we discussed at some length the parameters of the obligation to testify. Tonight I want to discuss the six-word phrase, v'hu eid o ra'a o yada. What is a person who should be testifying? He is a witness, which means either ra'a, either he saw something, or yada, he knows something, and he should testify, and he does not. This little phrase, these six words, actually form the textual basis for pretty much the entire Talmudic and halachic discussion of the role that circumstantial evidence plays in halacha. Anyone who has studied Talmud, anyone who's been at a Jewish wedding really, knows that the primary role that eyewitness testimony, two witnesses generally, has in halacha. A wedding has to be witnessed by two witnesses. We have the Eid Kedushin, ksuva signed by two witnesses. The actual halacha is you don't actually have to designate two witnesses. As long as there are people in the hall who see the wedding, that's fine. The custom for the last couple hundred years has been that we designate specific witnesses, but that's one variation of this fundamental rule that the gold standard of evidence, of testimony in halacha, is two witnesses who see something, and if necessary, testify to that later. Ksuva is signed by two witnesses, divorces are signed and witnessed by two witnesses, and so on. And in general, in civil jurisprudence and halacha, the gold standard is, criminal jurisprudence too, the gold standard is always the testimony of two eyewitnesses. The question is that the Torah itself refers to this several times, Al Pishnayim Edim Yakum Davar, something shall be established based on the testimony of two witnesses, Al Pishnayim Edim Oshlosh Edim Yumas Ameis, based on the testimony of two or three or more witnesses, we can execute a criminal. The question is, what about circumstantial evidence? Obviously, we know in the Western tradition, in modern law, most cases are not decided, I imagine, on the basis of two eyewitnesses testifying. So even capital cases are routinely are decided based on circumstantial evidence, strong circumstantial evidence. The law has various standards, beyond a reasonable doubt, for criminal cases, preponderance of evidence, and so on. But most cases in the real world are not decided by two witnesses who actually saw exactly what happened testifying. We have the circumstances that lead us to a certain conclusion. So the question is, what role does circumstantial evidence play in halacha? Now, surprisingly, I'm still surprised by this, even though I've been aware of this for years. It is a surprisingly difficult question to answer. The Talmud's statements, discussions of this point are extremely murky, ambiguous, contradictory, and even in later codes, there is no real settled halacha. It's far from clear what the halacha is about the extent to which we can rely on circumstantial evidence. For the purpose of tonight's talk, there are two fundamental questions, closely interrelated questions, we have to consider, which is A, what is the weight halacha assigns to circumstantial evidence, and B, how do the standards of evidence vary between civil cases, criminal cases, capital cases, just as the law has different standards, beyond a reasonable doubt versus preponderance of evidence for criminal versus civil. Halacha 2, as we're going to see, has different standards, stricter standards, obviously, for criminal cases. So within the context of circumstantial evidence, are there different standards? How do they differ? Those are going to be the questions we need to consider. Just by way of a little background, so just as in modern law we have civil law, we have criminal law, halacha has the same basic distinction. In halacha, the terms we use are dine mamonos, that's basically civil law, monetary questions, questions where there's a plaintiff and a defendant, plaintiff wants some money from the defendant doesn't want to pay, and so on. There are criminal cases where people have violated sins for which the Torah prescribes punishment. In the Torah, in halacha, there are basically only two types of criminal cases. There are capital cases, where the defendant is executed if he's guilty, the arba mitzvah is based in. There are four types of capital punishment, but for our purposes, they're interchangeable. There are capital cases, capital averus. Those are basically chil Shabbos, murder, certain types of incest, idol worship, blasphemy. There's several dozen of them, but the most common ones that are talked about in the literature are typically Shabbos, idol worship, and a couple other ones. Then there are all other criminal cases. The only other criminal penalty prescribed by the halacha is malchus, the formal 39 lashes, arbaim yakenu, which means 39 according to rabbinic tradition. Those are the only two criminal types of punishments that exist. There's no jail, there's nothing else. So, roughly speaking, we can say that there are three types of litigation, three types of jurisprudential proceedings in halacha. There is civil, there is criminal in general, and then there is capital. Knossos is an interesting category. Knossos are literally translate to penalties. Knas is a very formal, rigorously defined category in halacha. They're essentially civil penalties that are paid by the defendant to the plaintiff, but they don't directly correspond to damages. In law, we talk about punitive damages. Perhaps knossos are similar. Knossos are penalties that go above and beyond, or in addition to, or independent of restitution. You pay, for example, kefil. A ganav pays back whatever he stole plus kefil, plus another amount equal to what he stole. Dalad vehei, if you steal a sheep or a cow, you pay four times or five times the amount. So that's true. There are actually more than the three categories I mentioned. There's davar shebe'erva. There is a family case which have their own standards. There are some other cases, but for our purposes, we're going to lump those together with the knossos would be in roughly the same category, I think, as ordinary civil cases for our purposes, where we deal with things like standards of evidence. There are some differences having to do with confession. We'll return to that later, maybe. But for our purposes, we'll consider knossos a form of civil cases as opposed to criminal. A criminal itself will break down into capital specifically, and then all other criminal, which is basically malchus. As we're going to see tonight, there is a certain ambiguity sometimes when we refer to non-civil cases. Criminal cases, some of the literature seems to be referring specifically to capital. Other aspects of the literature seem to refer in general to any criminal case, not always clear. So we're going to kind of use them somewhat interchangeably, which is not entirely accurate, but that's because the literature doesn't always distinguish clearly between non-capital criminal and capital criminal. So the question is, again, what is the role circumstantial evidence plays, and how are the standards different for civil versus criminal? And as I said, a lot of the discussion really revolves around this six-word phrase, who aid, o ra, o yada. A witness is someone who has either seen something or who knows something. Now, by the simple construction of that expression, we have that someone can either see or he might not have seen, but he might know something anyway. The implication clearly is someone can know something which enables him to testify without actually having seen something. Talmud makes this point. Rashi brings it. The Talmud makes this point. Talmud calls this yediyah below re'iyah. Knowledge without having seen something. This is the notion of yediyah below re'iyah. The Talmud says when it comes to dinei mamonos, when it comes to civil cases, that's where there is the possibility of yediyah below re'iyah. The Talmud indicates that outside of civil cases, when it comes to capital or criminal cases, there is no possibility of yediyah below re'iyah. The Talmud makes this point indirectly. The Talmud in Shavuos says, this is the opinion of Rabbi Yossi Aglili, that hu eid o ra o yada is equivalent to civil cases. There is no such possibility of, the Gemara seems to say, the Gemara begins with the assumption, there is no such possibility of yediyah below re'iyah, of knowledge without vision in criminal cases. The Gemara says, is that really so? Let's consider if that's really true. The Gemara says, wait a second. There is a machlokas between Rabbi Acha and the Chachamim. The Machlokas is in a somewhat curious case, but basically the Gemara is describing what we would call circumstantial evidence. The case was Gomel Ha'ocher Bein Agmalim. Ocher is a difficult word to translate. Basically, it means that the aggressor Gomel, the aggressor camel, the perpetrator, is thrashing around, either mating according to one Pshat in Rashi, or it's just behaving wildly, it's having a tantrum of some sorts. But the one of the Gomels, the aggressor Gomel, is acting wildly. Then when the dust clears, we see the victim Gomel is dead, injured or dead at its feet. We didn't actually see the putative perpetrator Gomel strike the other Gomel and injure it, but we see that it was behaving pretty wildly, and now there's another one dead. The question is, assuming these camels belong to two different people, normally the rule is the owner of an animal that injures another animal is chayev, the famous my ox goring your ox in Parshas Mishpatim we read not that long ago, v'chigov sharish asharayev ames, and so on. So normally a person has complicated rules, of course, but normally a person does have liability for the actions of his animal, he's considered liable for failing to secure it properly. In this case, though, we don't have the actual smoking gun is a bad word, because as we're going to discuss soon, smoking gun might also be considered circumstantial, but we don't have the actual eyewitness testimony, but we have strong circumstantial evidence. This looks like this is what happened. We saw one Gomel thrashing around, we saw another Gomel dead, we would like to assume that he killed him. So Rabbi Acha says, Chayev, Biyaduash is a hargo, you can presume that it was the aggressor and it killed it. And the Chacham saying, no, you don't have proof, you don't have eyewitness testimony, we cannot find the owner of that camel liable. So the Gemara says, if you accept, now the halacha is not entirely clear, the Talmud doesn't take sides here. La halacha, just to jump ahead a little bit, most, virtually all poskim rule like the Chachamim that we would not decide a civil case based on at least this level of circumstantial evidence of Gomel Ha'ocher Bein Agmal. But the Talmud says, if you do hold like Rav Acha, if we do accept the position of Rabbi Acha that the circumstantial evidence of the camel is sufficient to find somebody liable civilly for being the owner of such a camel, then we can construct an analogous scenario in the criminal context. What might that be? So now the Talmud introduces the famous story of Rabbi Shimon ben Shetach. Rabbi Shimon ben Shetach says he personally was once involved in a story, Erev ben Nechama, I swear, he says, language of an oath. He says, once I saw somebody chasing somebody else into a ruin, into an abandoned building. So I saw him chasing him with murder in his eyes, basically. I chased them. I followed them. I found the pursuer was holding a knife, a bloody knife. Blood was dripping from the knife. I found the victim was spasming on the ground, harug mefarper. And that's what I saw. I didn't see the act of murder. I told the perpetrator, Russia, I said, you villain, you scoundrel, who killed him? We're the only ones here, you and me, and it wasn't me. He said, who killed him, me or you? So I know exactly what happened here. Avol ma'ese, what can I do? She'ein damcha maser biyadi. I am powerless to do anything to bring you to justice. Shari amra Torah al pishnayim edim o shlosha edim yumas ames. The Torah says two witnesses are required. There is some ambiguity here, as to the Rishonim say, as to whether he meant we don't have two witnesses, meaning my testimony, if I brought you to court, could convict you, but I don't have someone else to testify, and one witness is not acceptable. Or he meant that I don't have eyewitness testimony, so even if there was somebody else with me, maybe there was, I still couldn't convict him because there wasn't. We didn't have witness to the murder. In any event, the Gemara introduces this type of scenario. You see somebody chasing somebody. You see the victim dead or dying. You see the apparent perpetrator holding a bloody knife. Nevertheless, the Gemara says this is equivalent to Gomel Ha'ocher Bein Agmalim. This is an equivalently strong level of circumstantial evidence. The Gemara indicates that if we accept the view of Rabbi Acha that we could find the owner of the camel liable, then in a criminal case, in a capital murder case, we could find this apparent perpetrator chayev, and we could execute him for murder. If we follow the opinion of the Chachamim that we cannot hold the owner of the camel liable, then similarly we could not find this murderer liable, guilty in a capital case. Some of you might be wondering that there's a rule of Hasra, that normally we have to warn the murderer before he gets killed. We sure don't deal with that. They struggle with explaining what happened to Hasra. We're not going to get into that right now. But the Gemara basically draws this parallel between Rabbi Acha in the civil case of the camels and Rabbi Shimon ben Shetach in the capital murder case. The Gemara pretty clearly implies that there is no difference in the standard of evidence. If we accept The Gemara seems to imply that these two examples of circumstantial evidence are of the same strength. If we paskin like Rabbi Acha, we would similarly convict a fellow of capital murder. If not. So the Gemara indicates that, is there a difference in standard? The Gemara implies, no, there is not. As to the question of whether we do or do not accept strong circumstantial evidence, the answer is, both with regard to civil and with regard to criminal, it is a machlokas tanaim. The Gemara does not resolve the machlokas. As I said, the Rambam, the Shulchan Aruch, the Tur, most poskim rule like Rabbi Acha, rule like the Chacham of Rabbi Acha, that we do not allow circumstantial evidence, even in a civil case, certainly not in a criminal case. So the question now is, do we accept, is this position of the Gemara, is this normative? Do we accept that the standards are equivalent? And if we do, is there any level of circumstantial evidence which is tight enough, which is compelling enough, that would allow us to act in civil and criminal cases? So we turn now to a parallel passage in Sanhedrin. The Gemara in Sanhedrin is going through due process in criminal cases. The Gemara says that when we have witnesses testify in a criminal case. So it says we have to impress upon the witnesses the enormity, the gravity of what they're about to do, to send a man to his death. So it says we are ma'aymin al ha'edim. We put the fear of God into them. We try to awe them with the magnitude of what they're doing. So we tell them that make sure that you're telling us the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth. Make sure you tell us exactly what you saw without changing, without adding, without embellishing. So one of the things is, the Gemara says, we ask the Edim, did you actually see exactly what you were telling us? Or are you testifying, may Omed, are you testifying based on, you assume this is what happened based on what you saw. You're extrapolating from what you saw to the conclusion. We want to know exactly what you saw, just the facts, nothing more. And we do not allow Omed. We do not allow them to testify based on an Umdana. So this is, again, this is mentioned in the context of due process in a criminal case. It's the entire Mishnah gives many details of the judicial process specifically for criminal cases, apparently. So the Gemara infers, Dinin Nefashos, Hu D'Lam Dinan. In Dinin Nefashos, that's where we disallow Omed, we disallow circumstantial evidence, but in Dinin Mamonos, we would allow circumstantial evidence. The Gemara begins with the assumption that there is a lower standard for civil cases than criminal cases, certainly than for capital cases. Whose opinion is this? The Gemara says this is Rabbi Acha's opinion. Rabbi Acha says that we allow circumstantial evidence for civil cases, and we do not allow it for criminal cases. So this seems to be a flat-out contradiction to the Talmudic passage in Shavuos, which clearly says that the standards are the same, and according to Rabbi Acha, that we accept circumstantial evidence for civil cases, we accept it for criminal cases too. The Gemara in Sanhedrin says no. Rabbi Acha would be only good for civil, would not be good for criminal. So many Rishonim ask this contradiction. The main approach given is that the Ikar is like the sugya in Shavuos. Lahalacha, we say that the standard is the same. The Gemara in Sanhedrin says it's a different standard. The Gemara goes on. The Gemara says the maskana is that the Mishnah could be even the Chachamim, and even though circumstantial evidence would not be accepted neither for criminal cases nor for civil cases, still, when it comes to criminal cases, because of the enormity of what we might do, there we take extra precautions to rule out the possibility of circumstantial evidence. So it's just as disallowed in both cases, but we go the extra mile to make sure that no one is accidentally substituting circumstantial for criminal. But lahalacha, circumstantial evidence, according to the Chachamim, would not be acceptable for either. And the implication is that according to Rabbi Acha, circumstantial evidence would be accepted for both for civil and criminal. This is probably the most popular opinion in the Rishonim, Tosfos, the Ritva, other Rishonim. Rav Chana Wasserman seems to assume this is the this is the default standard opinion of most Rishonim, that the halacha is like the Gemara in Shavuos. The standard is the same for both civil and criminal. And the question that remains is there any level of circumstantial evidence that would be acceptable for civil and maybe even criminal cases? That's a question we'll return to a little bit later. We turn now to the comments of the Rambam. The Rambam discusses circumstantial evidence in a number of places. The Rambam has very interesting remarks on the topic. Most of what he says is based on the Talmud, although the way he codifies it and the way he phrases it yields some interesting conclusions. The Rambam, the first passage we'll turn to is from the Sefer HaMitzvos. The Rambam, in one of his 613 mitzvahs, mitzvahs losase, negative commandment number 290, the Rambam has an injunction, a prohibition against convicting someone in a capital case by circumstantial evidence. This is not based on any passage in the Talmud. This is based essentially on a midrash, a mechilta. The Rambam brings the mechilta. It brings a case very similar to Shimon Shetach. You see somebody pursuing somebody else. You see the victim dying. You didn't see the actual act of murder itself. Is he chayev? Mechilta says no. The case is very similar to the Bavli, but the Bavli didn't say anything about a mitzvah, about one of the 613 mitzvahs. The mechilta says there is a pasuk, v'naki v'tzadik al taharog, you shall not kill literally an innocent or a righteous person. Now, to use modern language for a moment, we talk about, in modern law, we talk about substance and process, so we would read this pasuk normally as, if he's substantially innocent, then obviously don't kill him. The Midrash and various statements in Chazal interpret this to be a statement about a rule about process. V'naki v'tzadik al tarog, it's telling you the standard of process, that you need eyewitness testimony. If he's naki, if he's innocent in the eyes of the law, innocent until proven guilty, it doesn't matter what we think, it doesn't matter what we know based on circumstantial evidence, the Rambam says, the Mechilta says, in the eyes of the law, he is naki. If the standards of process have not been met, he is naki, and you cannot convict him. The Rambam says, this is one of the 613 mitzvahs, do not execute a capital defendant in the absence of eyewitness testimony. The Rambam goes on, explains, the Rambam says, you may be very bothered by this, he says, that this sounds corrupt, this sounds wrong, he's guilty, he's black, his soul is black as anything, he says, why are you not killing him? So the Rambam, on his own apparently, maybe he has a source, but the Rambam proposes an explanation for this, which we would call a slippery slope argument. The Rambam says, once you're dealing with circumstantial evidence, once you open the door, he actually uses the phrase open the door, he says that if you would be pasach es hadeles to allowing circumstantial evidence, there's a complete spectrum of circumstantial evidence to virtually logically necessary, to probable, to plausible, to I think so, to my gut tells me so. So there's a very slippery slope down that hill, he says. Ilu hirshasa Torah l'kayim onshim be'efshar akarav ma'od. Even if the Torah would say, okay, you can use circumstantial evidence, but keep it to things which are virtual certainty. Asher kamat karav l'machayev ha-metzias. That's almost logically necessary, almost absolutely necessary, necessarily true. Machayev ha-metzias is philosophical jargon they used to use, meaning it's necessarily true, not just using Aristotle's language, not just incidentally true, but necessarily true, absolutely necessarily true. I think, he says, then people would gradually move from there to imposing criminal penalties, capital punishment, even in cases which are not quite so compelling, and they would go further and further until they would wind up killing people unjustly, ba'omd and kal, with just an intuition, an assumption, he says, according to the judge's guess, he says, therefore the Torah sasim as a pesach, the Torah completely closed the door on any possibility of circumstantial evidence, at least in capital cases. You need Edim who witnessed the story. He says, "Eif shalos v'yirachares b'shem ofen." There was no other way to rationally explain why the Torah insisted on eyewitness testimony and not circumstantial evidence. That must be the explanation. Now, from a modern criminology standpoint, I never really studied this, but as a layman, what I read is that we're actually not so convinced that in general eyewitness testimony should really be the gold standard. There are all kinds of cases of witnesses who either lie or jump to conclusions, who think they saw. There are all kinds of studies that show how open people are to the power of suggestion, to manipulation, certainly, by a skilled prosecutor or whoever. So not at all clear that circumstantial evidence as a rule is less reliable than eyewitness testimony, but the halacha, this is the position of the halacha. The halacha says, maybe just less of a slippery slope, the Torah feels that eyewitness testimony is less prone to abuse, less prone to sliding down a slippery slope, while circumstantial evidence, even if there is a class of circumstantial evidence which meets the standard of proof, which by which we can assume that what happened is just as likely as if eyewitness testimony, if not more, it's too dangerous to open the door to such proof. Therefore, the Torah bars us completely from using any such proof. Then the Rambam goes on. He has one last line, the paragraph where I have an underlined line here. He says, Ram says, nope, worst case scenario. What are we going to do? We're not going to accept circumstantial evidence in a capital case. What's going to happen? So some guilty men will walk. Some guilty men will not be convicted, will not be punished. Okay, that's the worst that can happen, he says. Avali says, in the Kayamas Aunshin Ba'omer Vadimoy, if we would impose penalties based on assumptions and intuition and so on, and simple conviction that something is true, Efshiri says, Shabayomin Hayomim Naharag Naki, we could eventually arrive, the day will come, we will kill an innocent person. Then the Rambam says, Yoser Tov, Yoser Ratzri Liftar Elef Chotim, it is better and it is more appropriate to let 1,000 guilty men go free than to kill one innocent man at some point in the future. In Western law, this is known as Blackstone's formulation. You can read an entire Wikipedia page on it. There actually, it appears well before Blackstone. It goes back to medieval jurists, a fellow named Fortescue, who apparently, 15th century or so, who talked about this, and Increase Mather, one of the Puritans during the Salem witch trials. He was actually concerned about what was happening there, for good reason, obviously. They weren't necessarily concerned about executing witches. Witches are supposed to be executed, both according to the Puritans and according to Pasha Mishpatim. That's a topic for a different day. They were concerned about the process violations, again, that perhaps not all the people that were executing, all these poor women and girls, were actually guilty of witchcraft. So the process, he felt, was problematic. There is this incredibly funny and brilliant paper that I quote briefly by a lawyer, Alexander Volokh. He traces dozens and dozens, the paper has some 250 footnotes, dozens and dozens of versions of this formula, better to let and guilty men go free. Rambam actually is one of the earliest, apparently. The Rambam is one of the earliest formal codifications of this phrase. But the better that n guilty men should go free than that we should kill, punish, jail one innocent man. He goes through what is the number of n in all these different formulations. The Rambam has 1,000 even. Others had, Blackstone had 10. Someone had 20. Someone had 5. Someone had 3 or 4. He goes through at great length. But it's a very, very funny paper. And the last line of the paper, he underscores the problem with this formulation. It sounds very stirring. It sounds so noble and so upright. The problem is, if you really insist on zero possibility of false positive, you might as well shut down the criminal justice system, because no system is perfect. Eyewitness testimony is not perfect, too. As a matter of fact, Shimon ben Shetach himself was involved in a story. He made some enemies. He killed some witches. Actually, it happened with witches, too. He made some enemies. He killed a number of witches. The witches' families were not happy with this, so they hired false witness to testify that his own son, Shimon Shetach's son, had been guilty, I think, of blasphemy, and he was executed. So, you know, obviously witnesses can be manipulated too. They can hire false witnesses, they can be mistaken. No system is perfect. Here we have, certainly the American legal system, as good as it may be, we have the Innocence Project, which has gotten, I think, hundreds of people off of capital convictions, and some of those were just technicalities. They were still guilty, but some of those were what the law calls actually innocent. Technical term that means they weren't just freed on a technicality; they actually didn't do what they were convicted of doing. So,
it's mostly DNA.
Yeah, mostly DNA, right? We'll discuss DNA soon, but yes. But the point is, no system is perfect, and DNA actually cuts both ways. We'll discuss a little bit later. Sometimes a DNA conviction can be an error, not because science makes mistakes, really, but because technicians make mistakes and implementation of science makes mistakes. And conversely, sometimes the conviction will be based on witnesses or circumstantial evidence or bloody footprints or whatever, and DNA exonerates. So that cuts both ways. But the point is, no system is perfect, and any system of justice has to accept in the real world that you're going to have to sacrifice some possibility of false positives in order to... as a price you have to pay for getting some guilty. That's what this Chinese law professor said. You say it's better for whom? It might be better for the people getting off. It might not be better for general society if you don't convict anybody ever of crime. So obviously you have to accept there's a balance. And like all law, like all halacha, we don't deal in platitudes. I mean, sometimes we do, but the point is that ultimately you have to accept that if you're being serious, you have to accept that there are costs on both sides, and you have to find some kind of optimum, whether it's a mathematical optimum, whether it's a moral optimum. The point is, there are costs on both sides. You have this discussion, just one of my pet peeves, I have to get it off my chest. You have this discussion a lot these days about security. The libertarians, which I'm actually sympathetic to, but the libertarians always love to quote Benjamin Franklin or whoever it is, a society which gives up some essential liberty for the hope of security will get neither security or liberty. That's just silly. Everyone agrees you have to give up some security for some liberty. The question is some liberty for some security. The question is how much liberty for how much security. You know, we have to have some police and some checks and some rules. The question is what kind of rules and how intrusive. And you can't just farm out the hard work of thinking and making decisions, these kind of ringing but ultimately empty platitudes. You have to make decisions, and you have to decide what price you're willing to pay. So the Rambam is making the point over here that 1,000 people should go free, at least in capital cases, rather than even one innocent person should be free. At the end of the day, though, the Rambam surely understood there's a trade-off, and you have to decide what the trade-off is going to be. The trade-off applies to eyewitness testimony, too. The Rambam explains that halacha fails if the trade-off that would be necessitated by relying on the slippery slope of circumstantial evidence is too high a price to pay. Again, we keep pointing out, v'naki v'tzadik al tarog, this mitzvah number 290 is all concerning capital cases. What about civil cases? The Rambam strongly implies that in civil cases we're not so restrictive. In civil cases, we would allow circumstantial evidence. The horror of killing an innocent person doesn't apply. Now again, what about non-capital criminal cases? Also not clear. If you really focus on v'naki v'tzadik al tarog, the implication might be that even non-capital, even criminal cases, if they're non-capital, might have the lower standard. So not much discussion I found about that. But at least with regard to civil cases, the Rambam strongly implies that for civil cases, we do allow at least some types of circumstantial evidence. Others are not happy with this at all. The Ramban, in his comments to the Sefer HaMitzvahs, the Ramban pushes back on the Rambam. He says the Rambam is making a big mistake. V'naki v'tzadik al tarog, as if there's some special, the Rambam is implying there's some special rule for capital cases. Not correct, the Ramban says, as we saw in the Gemara in Shavuos, circumstantial evidence is never accepted, not even in civil cases, and there is no special prohibition with regard to capital cases. Now, some explain, Rabbi Chana Wasserman and others explain, that the Rambam also agrees that there is no special standard for criminal cases. The standard is the same for both criminal and civil cases. Circumstantial evidence is not accepted. What the Rambam means is, kind of like we said in the Gemara in Sanhedrin, the Rambam means there is a special prohibition against relying on circumstantial evidence in criminal cases. You shouldn't do it ever, but in criminal cases, the Torah wanted to have an extra prohibition to make sure that the innocents are protected. But the actual standard is the same for both. Others, however, disagree. Others argue, based on the Rambam's own language elsewhere, others argue that, nope, finally, that there are different levels of circumstantial evidence, that there is such a thing as basic circumstantial evidence that we paskin like the Rambam paskins, we don't paskin like Rabbi Acha. In the case of the camel case, that's not a slam dunk. The camel was wild. It's likely that it killed it, but something else could have happened. We're not sure what happened. That level of circumstantial evidence is not acceptable even for civil cases. There is a much higher level of circumstantial evidence, perhaps the case of Shimon Shetach, where you saw the guy chasing him, you saw him with a bloody knife, you saw the victim dead, you don't see anybody else around. In a case like that, some achronim argue, in a case like that, that would work for civil cases, but still, the Rambam says, v'naki v'tzadik al tarog, still does not work for criminal cases. Avnei Nezer, one of the last sources on the list, Avnei Nezer says, the umdin of Shimon ben Shetach, of the guy with the bloody knife, that would be fine, the equivalent to that case would be fine for a civil case, just v'naki v'tzadik al tarog, not for a criminal case. But a weaker level of circumstantial evidence would be fine. Would not be fine even for civil cases. The Achiezer of Chaim Ozer Grudzinski takes essentially the same position. Says that the Rambam means there is some basic level of circumstantial evidence that would be good, even not a basic level. There's a particularly strong, compelling level of circumstantial evidence that would be sufficient for civil cases. That's the case. Even that's ruled out for criminal cases. But they didn't today, of course, don't do criminal cases. What we're mostly interested in is the civil question. Is there a level of circumstantial evidence which would be accepted for civil cases? So on the one hand, the Rambam brings Rabbi Acha, brings the camel case, and says that you need absolute proof, eyewitness testimony, even for civil cases. Yet, some achronim argue, based on the Rambam's comments about Naki V'tzadik al tarog, that there is some pretty reliable level of circumstantial evidence which would be sufficient for civil cases. This is really the position of Tosfos too. If we return to the Tosfos back in the Gemara in Shavuos, in the first source, the last paragraph, Tosfos says, the Gemara in Shavuos seems to make an equivalence, not like the Rambam, the Gemara in Shavuos seems to make an equivalence between civil and criminal cases. If so, says Tosfos, even if we don't accept Rabbi Acha, I can find you a type of circumstantial evidence which does work for civil cases and therefore should work for criminal cases too, even capital cases. Tosfos brings a Gemara, it's called the Umdana of the Nechbal. Nechbal means victim of a battery, of personal injury. The Gemara talks about a case where normally if a person claims he was injured by somebody else, there would be an oath required of him to substantiate his claim. He would have to assert that the injury occurred under penalty of perjury by taking an oath. There is an exception, the Gemara says, kind of a locked room mystery scenario where two people, Reuven and Shimon, are in a room, nobody else is around, and then we see an injury, we saw Reuven go in without the injury, Reuven comes out with an injury. The Gemara says, well, that's not proof, maybe he fell and hit his head on the radiator. So the Gemara says, no, the injury, this is a little gruesome, I'm sorry, the Gemara says the injury is bite marks. So they must have been caused by another animal, human or animal, and there was nobody else but the putative perpetrator. Tosu says, so if that's true, and the Gemara says in such a case, you can dispense with the oath, the way Tosu understands, that is considered absolutely probative. We can use that to convict in a civil case, convict the apparent perpetrator of civil damages. Tosu says, based on the Gemara and Shavuos, if we assume that there is no difference in standard between civil and criminal cases, it would follow if you construct a similar case involving a capital crime, a murder that was caused by a bite in such a way that it couldn't have been done by anybody except the defendant, then we would actually convict the murderer of murder and execute him based on overwhelmingly compelling circumstantial evidence. So the position of Tosfos is, unlike the Rambam, he does not accept that there is any difference between civil and criminal cases. However, like the Rambam, at least like the Rambam is understood by the Chiezer and the Avnezer, he also understands that there is, despite the fact that the Gemara says the camel umdana is not strong enough, there is a level of umdana, there is a level of overwhelmingly strong circumstantial evidence that would be enough for civil cases, and Tosfos implies even for criminal cases. Again, the criminal cases is not of such practical significance because we don't do criminal cases today, but civil cases, both Tosfos and some interpretations of the Rambam agree that there is a very airtight level of umdana, which would, despite the Rambam's talk about slippery slope, at least for civil cases, maybe even for criminal cases, we would accept a certain level of overwhelming certainty, even though you don't have actual eyewitness testimony. You had the coroner. You did the forensic autopsy. Cause of death is with a high certainty was hoof through the head.
You can come to a wall of doubts and confusion, but the other type of drisha v'chakira, you could actually come to a situation where you have a plausible mechanism with an associated statistical probability that there's no other way this could happen. So there, in other words, that sort of undoes the notion of anus. If you look at, if you had a situation where camels were just dropping all the time because they had some viral syndrome.
Yeah, my one.
This camel could have also dropped because.
My one comment to that, I know that the real world is not books and movies. My one comment is you read enough mystery novels, situations that don't seem to have any other solution, at least in books, often do. Whether life imitates art to that extent or not, I'm not sure, but you have to be really, really careful before you say there is no other way this could have happened.
So is there any discussion about what might have happened to the camel? Because I could see various scenarios.
Alternative scenarios?
Not really. I don't necessarily mean alternative scenarios, but different levels of what somebody could have seen or not seen. For example, if you know one camel is fluent, but you don't actually see one hoof hit the other camel, then you may not be able to testify you saw that. But if you just see there's a lot of dust around and one camel is flowing and one camel is just standing there and it falls over, but you can't actually see it. Maybe the camel is walking.
Right, so we don't have much beyond what I've discussed, these paradigms, these examples. We don't have much in the sense of further rigorous development of these levels. To some extent, the law, obviously we have a lot of precedents, but the law tends to use also very kind of artful words like beyond a reasonable doubt, which based on the normal dictionary meaning of those words can mean can mean almost anything. What's reasonable? Reasonable by whose standards? Or preponderance of evidence? The law often uses words that are vague. We turn to precedent. We turn to how the courts develop. But halakha probably would work a similar way too. There isn't that much actual halakha l'maisa literature on these topics that we could turn to. So I don't have that much that would help pin down more precisely exactly what level.
To circumstantial evidence and things that are possible, so how do you weigh these things? In other words, I have a person. We have circumstantial evidence, which is sort of murky. But we also, let's say, we had a katan who saw something or an in heaven and saw the entire thing. Or we have a video camera that shows us what happened. So we have other ways of knowing things that are not necessarily through the mechanism of
faith. I'll get to some of that in a minute. What were you saying?
You had mentioned at one point, alluded to DNA evidence. I was wondering, for example, how Halakha would view, for example, DNA evidence in, for example, paternity suit. Just the woman's word against the man's word, but let's say.
Right. So I actually have an entire lecture on that, which we can cover another time in detail. But just to touch on the basis of that, there is actually what both Dr. Ettinger and you were both pointing out, that the question of how do we deal, particularly with modern sources of information, for example, the video recordings, the DNA. There's actually discussion in contemporary poskim about polygraphs, obviously a lot less reliable than DNA. There actually, Rav Avadia Seif and others have discussed lie detectors. So there actually is discussion about how reliable would this be. So the DNA specifically, just briefly, DNA is discussed in modern poskim in about 8 or 10 different contexts. It is discussed in paternity questions, which regards both questions of kahuna, if somebody's a kohen, but even more pressingly was often discussed with regard to civil questions, so questions of child support and so on. Naguna questions, if you have remains and you want to identify who the person is, they're discussed in Avelos questions. Should a person sit Shiva for a relative who's presumed dead based on DNA testing? Mamzerus, personal status questions. And poskim do discuss, at least academically, criminal cases. Would you convict based on DNA? Although, again, that wasn't halakha l'maaseh, that was discussed more in theoretical terms. So just briefly, and to give with some of the conclusions, with regard, so this is a question where the standards are assumed to be different in all these various cases. With regard to Aguna, that's a case where poskim are very willing, are looking to find, Aguna we have a kind of meta halacha consideration to try to look for kulos. We do try to look for whatever we can, and this consensus somewhat of leading poskim is that we do accept DNA, permit a woman to remarry, whether we accept it by itself or a combination with other things, but such leading luminaries as Rav Eliashuv from the Haredi community in Eretz Yisrael, Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg from the moderate Haredi community in Eretz Yisrael, Rav Mordechai Willig from YU in correspondence with Rav Goldberg and others, Shlomo Zalman Orbach is quoted this way, many of the leading poskim have assumed that we would use DNA for Aguna, to help an Aguna remarry. With regard to making somebody a mamzer, poskim are much less reluctant, because here, much more reluctant to use it, because here the meta halacha considerations are in reverse. We try very hard not to make somebody a mamzer because it's such a terrible fate. Here poskim have looked for reasons not to accept it. How that's logically consistent is a question about halachic methodology for another day. But with regard to Shiva and other cases, poskim go back and forth. With regard to paternity, with regard to civil cases, that's a classic civil law question, and that there the standard is more kind of, there that's really what we're talking about today. Would we accept overwhelmingly strong circumstantial evidence to make a civil ruling? Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg, who has written some of the seminal discussions of using DNA, he's given some of the numbers. He has numbers like ones with 12 zeros, the chance of getting a coincidental match, and so on. That's why he argues it's a virtual certainty, and for Aguna, he was talking about you can use it. So the question is, would something with such a high degree of certainty work in a civil case? That's a tricky question. So on the one hand, as I mentioned earlier, the science is indeed as reliable as one. The math is certainly reliable. The science is pretty reliable these days. The problem, of course, is that humans are not always so reliable. The Atlantic, Rav Aaron Lapiansky showed me an Atlantic article a year ago or so, that had terrible cases throughout the country of criminal cases where the DNA evidence was handled quite badly. Some of it was simple. The Atlantic, yes. Oh. Some of it was simply.
That's not illegal.
No, but it was just meant to show, just quoting actual cases that have been overturned, just going through the. Yes, obviously the plural of anecdotes is not data. We know that, but the point is that the. Just to show what kind of errors occur, the science is good and the math is good, but human error is a problem. The technicians are not always trained, and even when they are, the other point that has to be remembered, especially in criminal cases, maybe not in paternity cases as much, but especially in criminal cases, what we have to remember is that a lot of these very high convictions of certainty occur when you have pristine samples in the laboratory obtained under optimal conditions that are not mixed with other samples. Then you can say, you know, odds of a random false positive are overwhelmingly small. Real world cases where there's mud and there's degradation of the DNA and there are several DNAs mixed and you're trying to, and you don't have a large sample, and you're trying to piece together bits and pieces of fragments. You know, I don't know this stuff in detail, but real world certainty is not always there. You're relying on technicians' assessments of what it is. Real world, there is possibility for abuse. A case like paternity is more in between. You can get presumably, you know, optimal samples under better conditions, and hopefully you can get more reliable results. So on the one hand, just to summarize what we have, many post-com accept that there is a level of circumstantial evidence which approaches certainty to a sufficient degree we would rely on for civil and maybe even criminal cases, maybe even capital cases. Some post-com though reject this. Some post-com argue that some post-com take a more absolutist line. As I mentioned earlier, it's kind of strange that halakha hasn't reached a consensus on whether there is an allowable standard of circumstantial evidence, but there are post-com who have taken the view that the DNA and other things cannot, you know, anytime, any type of halakha context that requires two eyewitnesses to testify, DNA is not that. DNA would not be accepted. So with regard to paternity, my understanding is that post-com would differ as to whether one of the strongest proponents of using DNA in such cases is Rav Chaim David Regensburg of Chicago, a generation or two ago. He argued very strongly that all this talk about umdana and circumstantial evidence is before you cross a line into what halacha calls certainty. Once you cross this line into what we call certainty, it leaves the whole level of umdana and circumstantial evidence. That's just called fact. That's just called given. There's nothing to talk about. Again, you know, given in the mathematical sense, you know, we say that the chair, you know, this chair is, you know, I can say I'm certain this chair will remain on the floor. Technically, you know, there are quantum motions of particles and there are all kinds of random fluctuations. There is a tiny, very small chance the chair can rise up into the air or the atmosphere of the room can, but, you know, it's negligible. And for real world purposes, we call that certainty. So Rabbi Regensburg's point, I think, is yes, you know, there's a 1 in 12, you know, quadrillion or whatever it is chance of a false match. But halacha, for real world purposes, treats that as certainty. That's not considered circumstantial evidence anymore. That's considered certainty. But others disagree. Others fail. That until you have, that the Torah has a formal requirement of two eyewitnesses testifying, until that is met, that is all lumped into the category of circumstantial evidence and will not be accepted. One last quote. Rav Yonasan Eibschitz in the Rambam Tumim, he was one of the early ones to explicitly state that he allows circumstantial evidence. He says, makes a very sharp distinction between civil and criminal. He says, civil is just about knowing what happened. That's the only thing. We don't have, you know, formal or arbitrary process requirements. As long as we know what happened, that's it. If the strong circumstantial evidence tells us what happened, lo ivri sadi el l'shakri, if we know what happened, that's it. We can go home. We can finish our case. Criminal, the Torah sets up specific non-negotiable procedural rules for criminal cases. The example he gives is confession. A confession in a civil case is fine. It's always acceptable. We act on it, except for knas, as you mentioned before. But in criminal cases, confessions, this is one area where halacha is remarkably divergent from the law. Confessions have no worth whatsoever. They're simply tossed out, and not because they're coerced or anything. Confessions simply have no probative value. We need evidence and testimony. Vincent Eibschitz says that's a symbol, that's an indication that we are dealing with rigid halachic standards. It's not enough to know what happened. We need formal procedural hurdles to be met. Eyewitness testimony is required, and even overwhelmingly strong circumstantial evidence will not be sufficient in a criminal or at least in a capital case.